Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a series on the Berlin Film Festival, aka the Berlinale. I found a secluded place, mostly secluded place, to podcast. Within my immediate area is a journalist, I think, and a man who is sleeping, so, which is a spectrum of attention, I guess. I have with me to kick off the Berlin series, Jordan Kronk.
Hey, Nick. How are you?
Good. Wait, one year we podcasted it at the Arsenal, right above the Arsenal, right, I think?
Above the Arsenal. Was that the first year back from COVID, I think?
Yeah.
We had to get tested year every day.
Right. That was...
As I recall.
Oh, memories. This year, everything's back in full force, except, you know, the festival has its evolution.
Well, I mean, this is the fifth and final edition under the leadership of the artistic director, Carlo Chatrian, who's been more or less given an ultimatum to kind of take a different position or have a new director kind of come in and oversee his programming, which he was not okay with, so decided to part ways after what's been a fruitful 5 years for me, and people have similar ideas or taste in cinema. So it's a little bittersweet, but they've hired a new director to, I guess, take this kind of dual managing director / artistic director spot going forward.
That's right. That is the nature of the year, a pre-transitional year. But we can just dive into the films, I guess, although we may come back to some of the issues involved in putting on a festival of this magnitude as well, with all the various political issues that crop up in the rest of the world impacting here. But let's start maybe with one of the higher profile titles in the competition from Bruno Dumont. I was chuckling a little just because it is called Empire.
Yeah.
And... it's, I don't know. I don't
it's
even
a good
know
way to start.
Where to begin with this?
Yeah, I guess I can take a stab at it. This is Bruno Dumont's sci-fi space odyssey film, greatly anticipated for fans of Bruno Dumont, such as myself. He, as people probably know, has been on a run of making comedies and genre films after making many sobering, serious-minded films in the 2000s and late 90s. I guess there is genre elements in the early ones that he's just kind of... he's just like twisted the formula into like a different register.
Yeah.
That's like basically what the last 10 years have been for him. It's just the same aesthetic and like formal ideas, but like twisted into weird slapstick comedy, which I've really enjoyed. And this one now is... slightly even more ambitious than what he's been doing, but in a very like counterintuitive way. It's sort of hard to explain, even though it should be fairly straightforward. But I guess broadly, it deals with two warring like intergalactic knight clans that are each trying to procure or steal away a baby who is going to, I don't know, lead the next generation, the galaxy wars or something. So
yeah,
each of these like factions have sent a pair of, I guess, are they technically aliens? I don't know. They're in human skin.
Yeah, I guess they are extraterrestrial, but they're, inhabiting the bodies of humans. But I wasn't sure if that meant that the humans were, like, people before they inhabited them, or...
Yeah, I wasn't quite clear on some of
the metaphysics are still to be discovered by scholars.
But anyway, the characters are played by, you know, they're human people coming, they're on Earth, and they are... but there's a guy and a girl on each kind of side warring over this baby. And it is... essentially folds in elements of, like, Star Wars.
Yep.
There are lightsaber... not battles, but they're lightsaber like scenes where heads get chopped off.
Yeah.
And
although somehow without seeming like very grisly, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. But it's basically them, they're warring with each other, but the main guy at the center of the film, he's kind of playing both sides, literally in the sense that he's sleeping with a girl in both clans.
Right.
Which makes for some humorous elements in the film. But it's quite out there. I had a good time with it. It had a lot of walkouts, as expected. I don't know what to say about what he's doing anymore. He's like, he's in his own world. Like, there's literally no one making movies like this, and I find it refreshing to come to his world every now and then.
Yeah.
What I thought was funny about this one is I was expecting, well, I don't know what I was expecting, but I thought it would be like a real, maybe set in space or on another planet. But no, it's literally in the same like coastal town that he always shoots his movies in. It does end with a long like kind of space opera type sequence in the sky.
Yeah.
But like most of it's just people running around on the beachy area around the, like, what is it, the north of France, I think.
Yeah, where he shoots. It's the north of France.
And a lot of the same characters from like Petit Cancan, especially the two police officers who show up in like most of his recent movies.
Yeah.
And then the one guy is like aging now. He's like getting pretty old. I don't know how many more movies he's going to be making with
him.
He's
getting a little gaunt in the face,
yeah,
just a little.
But he still has that like protruding eyeball look, and he makes it like popping noises with his mouth.
And these the sort of manner ticks, basically.
Ticks, yeah. But I don't know. As far as I was actually talking to his fellow Dumont enthusiast earlier today, and we were talking, he's now made 7 comedies, and he made 7 serious films, for lack of a better word, serious films. So I don't know. He's split now completely. So I don't know what he's... I know they just announced a new project for him, which sounds also crazy. But yeah, it's just like halfway through or another phase in his career, it seems like. Because I always thought of his early work lasting a little bit longer than that, but it was also
right.
7 films. He had more gaps between films. Now he's a little more prolific, I think.
Right. That's interesting, counting him up like that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this film is... I watched it and I was kind of like... I hate this formulation of like, who is this movie for? But it felt like it was a movie, and
me.
I don't mean in a bad way. It felt like, it's for you. It's for Jordan. Jordan
Thank
then got a
Bruno.
Letter that says, you're welcome from Bruno Dumont. But just in the sense, because it is so tailored to his specific interest in this area and the style, I guess they're non-professionals as well, right?
Well, the two girls I know, one of them was in The French Dispatch, and she's like a model.
Oh, okay.
And then the other girl was the girl from Happening, the Audrey Diwan film.
Oh.
Which I did not put that together.
I
looked it up
either.
Earlier
yeah,
today.
Okay.
So she was in Happening as well, but they're both relatively young and newer actresses. But yeah, most of the other people are, I guess, non-actors. And then there's Fabrice Luchini as one of the lords.
Yeah.
Space lords. He's like the Sith overlord.
I mean, yeah, he's wearing like this Commedia dell'arte kind of outfit. And yeah, the settings are all so French as well. Like basically their Death Star or whatever the equivalent is a cathedral.
Yeah,
spaceship.
There was something, I don't know if you picked up on it or not, because
I probably
know my French history, or like just architecture in the land out there. I think one of those spaceships was supposed to be Notre Dame,
okay,
or was like supposed to look like that, and then the other one was another, I don't know if it was Versailles or something, but I think there's some like nationalist commentary going on with them flying on spaceships that look like French historical monuments and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm sure there's some way this is an allegory, but mostly it's... I mean, I did think afterwards, again, not in a bad way, it felt like one of these AI-generated things. You know, where it's you type into you give it the prompts of like, you know, Star Wars, low budget. It's not really low budget. I mean, it's part of it.
For
is.
Him, it's high budget,
it's
I
high
guess,
budget,
but
yeah.
It's probably not in the grand scheme of things.
Right, right. Star Wars, like CGI heavy Star Wars in the style of Bruno Dumont.
Yeah.
And then it would generate something like this movie or even like improv comedy where it's like do like Star Wars in the weirdly like downplayed Dumont manner.
Yeah. I don't know if you realize this. I totally forgot, but this is the movie like Adèle Haenel quit the film industry over. You remember that?
Oh, over this movie?
Yeah. She quit this movie and she was like used it as an example of like everything that's wrong with French cinema, that it's racist, it's patriarchal, it's...
Wow, okay.
And I mean, that's one way to read his cinema or, you know, recent cinema. But yeah, this is like the movie she was working on when she...
Okay.
She dropped out of it. A number of actresses were attached to it, I think.
Wow.
Like Lily Rose Depp, I think, was part of it for a while.
I mean, I can see that. I mean, it's worth mentioning that like the two main actresses are basically like in like crop tops or like...
Yeah.
Or even naked part of it. And one character is like... It's one of these like she's discovers sex through this like sleaze bowl and then... So, yeah, I definitely can see her not want to put up with that.
Well, that actually creates an interesting link with his early films, at least for me. Like, his recent work hasn't had that, like, feral aspect to it as much, because it's dealing more with, like, you know, funny or fantastical elements.
Yeah.
But this, like, has that kind of animal sexuality to it that, like, his early protagonists always would... Like, there's a lot of, like, sex in the open fields in his early films, and that has this a few times in this film. So it has a weird kind of link maybe to some of the earlier work that I hadn't seen in his stuff in a while. But.
That's interesting. Yeah, there's also this view of this countryside. I mean, there's something like it's Star Wars, but it's also as if it's like medieval mythical in some way, you know, medieval legend in some way. But it's, I don't know, it's just seeing it all played out with these like Clydesdale like horses.
He brought back the dancing horse from Joan of Arc. Do you remember there was that long sequence in Joan of Arc?
Right.
It was like a 5 or 6 minute sequence of just the horses like prancing around.
Right.
Yeah, that's back.
That's right. I forgot about that. Like I said, it's like a Bruno Dumont. I can just imagine him watching it and just like nodding along with it somehow. I mean, it is a weird, like, defamiliarizing experience watching it. Yeah, it just was sort of dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Because it's also, like, so self-conscious. Like, it can't really court an audience that you'd associate with these kind of, like, you know, space operas.
No way, yeah.
There's, like, an opacity to it, right. You know, the plotting.
And it has I won't spoil it, but, like, it's got a funny last line, which is, like, definitely a self-conscious just, like, yeah. joke, I guess, on the audience, or I don't know what, but it's a funny little last line.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize I would be so, like, tongue-tied about this movie. there's just something about it.
Speechless after The Empire.
Yeah. That's Empire coming soon.
Coming soon, yeah.
To a theater near you. It might be coming out soon, though, in France, though, I think.
I think it comes out next month in France.
Next month, or soon,
in France.
So we can talk about a movie that I was anticipating because it's a second movie or second feature by an Indian director whose first feature I liked a lot. The first one he did was called Pebbles. His name is P.S. Vinothraz, I think. And this one's called The Adamant Girl. Character of the title is a young woman who's been engaged to marry someone, but has apparently gotten involved with someone else.
Well, yeah, I think she's been, like, promised.
Promised.
Her family's promised her to another man that she doesn't want to marry, essentially.
Yeah. So the movie kind of starts in a sort of cryptic way of just, like, there's clearly great turmoil and, like, grief of some sort. What happens is they take her on this arduous, like, overland journey to a shrine where they can hopefully, they want to, like, walk her back and remove what it is.
They think she's possessed.
They think she's possessed. They were treating her determination as if it was, like, a curse.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, she's not really possessed. Yeah, yeah, I guess that's the whole thing. She just wants to marry. She would rather be with this old family friend or something, or classmate, I think it is, actually. So, yeah, the whole movie is basically, it's like a road trip film, sort of like Pebbles, and they...
Yeah.
It's kind of told episodically as they travel to the seer, and it's comedic, but there's also, like, extremely, like, violent scenes that are, like, jarring at some times, because there is a kind of a fun air to the film, because it's kind of like them cracking jokes. There's a couple comedic pairs of characters. The guys are kind of goofy sometimes. But, yeah, there's some elements of just physical abuse with the would-be husband physically assaulting the girl that he wants to be with because of this... You know, thinking she's possessed or whatever, and also his father-in-law. So yeah, there's some kind of more jarring elements in it as well.
Yeah, he has like an explosive temper.
Yeah,
turns violent, and just basically everyone kind of fears his wrath during this trip. And it's very much around this extended family.
Yeah, it's both families, I guess, and the women are in, like, a rickshaw, and the men are on motorcycles. Yeah. And they're bringing a rooster with them to complete the ritual, which they'll end up having to, you know, kill. So, but it's kind of an interesting look at that kind of, like, they keep it alive the whole time. And there's a part where it, like, passes out and they do some, like, they resuscitate it with, like, water and blowing in its face. It's just kind of, it has all these little cultural details in it that's very specific. And
yeah,
which is what I liked about his first film, too. And it's a little more high production value. Like, it clearly has a little more money than before, which Pebbles was, like, super rough and tumble, I guess. But this is a little more elegant, but it still has that, like, kinetic feel of his first film. And also what I like about his movies too, every scene is shot in an interesting way. Like, he finds a weird place to put the camera at all times.
Yeah.
So weird framings, it keeps you kind of off guard.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Pebbles was almost like kinetic, like dead alive. Like, you know, it's like to that extent of, like, the camera having this kind of plasticity to it. And there was something in this one where it felt a little monotonous and sort of supposed to in a little because it is just kind of this road trip that's taking forever. The Little Miss Sunshine without the sunshine.
I didn't think about that, but it sort of is.
I just felt also the actress who's playing the adamant girl.
Yeah.
Really keeps her cards close to her vest.
Well, that's the thing. She's not talking much. That's why they think she's also, like, under the spell of something.
Yeah.
Because she's, like, taking essentially like a vow of silence, sort of.
Yeah, which is tough dramatically.
Yeah.
I mean, and I did respect that it is a chronicle of this trip. I think I was maybe spoiled a little by Pebbles, but, you know, I'm curious to see what he makes after this. Clearly he's just kind of bursting with energy and sort of raw talent. So, and like a lot of, like, those new generations of filmmakers from India, each of which have this sort of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, did you see The Fable?
Oh, I did, yeah. I didn't dislike it, per se.
Okay.
It was just very hypnotic, and I don't know. It was not a bad movie at all, actually. It was sort of interesting, but very different from Adamant Girl, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's more of like a slow burn study of a family.
it came to mind because there was that, and then there was one other I was curious. But let's talk about just kind of a monument of the film that I have not seen. So I'm curious, what you can report about it. Exarg? Is that how it's pronounced?
Exarg, I think, yeah. I've had some debate about how it's pronounced. He said it's said in the film, and I think it is Exarg. Okay. But open to interpretation, I guess.
Okay.
If you may have heard about this film, it's already building up a little bit of a reputation. It is a 14-hour documentary about the organization of Documenta 14, which took place in 2017. Documenta is essentially the world's biggest and most prestigious art exhibition. It happens every 5 years in Kassel, Germany, except for that edition, which is one of the reasons why it was controversial and why they made a movie about it, I guess. It took place in two locations, also took place in Athens. So it was extremely ambitious. I think at the time it was the highest budgeted Documenta at that time. It ran a huge deficit, lost millions of euros in money. And I mean, it was framed as the curator bankrupted the institution, which I don't think was quite the truth.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that it became notorious is because the press really jumped on this kind of overspending and what right. they thought is cultural tourism between Germany going into Greece and kind of poaching some art from museums there, bringing it back, and also doing stuff there when Greece was in a huge economic
right.
austerity measures type of situation. So yeah, it essentially, to compare it to something, it was sort of a Wiseman type look at a institution where it takes in the entirety of the organizational process for an art exhibition. Mm-hmm. So you're talking inviting the artists, budget meetings, press conferences, and then just behind the scenes, arguments about how things are going to be presented or installed, or talking with the Minister of Culture about money situation and their CEO also with money situation. So it's very thorough, as you might expect for something so long.
Yeah.
Even though it is long, it is broken up into 14 chapters, about an hour long each. So it's not super demanding in that way.
Is it supposed to be a feature presentation, or is it, because if it's when it gets to be 14 hours, I wonder, is that a TV series, serial
thing?
Well,
they are calling it a film made for theatrical distribution.
Okay.
But I could totally see it playing on or being best consumed even as a series, in the sense that it's literally has chapter titles and breaks every okay. hour. The longest one, I think, is the last chapter. It's an hour and a half, a little under an hour and a half. So, and some are 40 minutes, so they range, but on average about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really fascinating look into specifically German kind of art culture.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the same issues that plagued that edition with the Ministry of Culture also have plagued the Berlinale this year, which is one of the main reasons Carlo is leaving. So there are parallels to be drawn, and I have done this myself, and there are many people that will continue to do so as well.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting things is for cinephiles who are interested in the history of Documenta, that edition of Documenta had quite a large cinema component.
Right.
Many films there premiered as installations, then it went on a few months later to play in Locarno, which Carlo was running at the time. So examples would be Wong Bing's Mrs. Fang, mm-hmm. Ben Russell's Good Luck, Narumana Mari's Le Four des Fous. So there was a number of films. They were all in Locarno that year. I think you were there at that one, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I remember seeing Mrs. Fang, which itself is also heavy.
Yeah, heavy. Yes.
if that's an example exactly. of something from that.
Yeah. So there were many installation versions of those films that technically premiered there, then a few months later had their theatrical premieres in Locarno. But it just has an interesting roundabout way, because Carlo program those films on Locarno, and now they're playing a film based on this exhibition that is also has ties to what's happening to the Berlinale now with him. So he's going through similar oversight and stresses related to just politics getting involved with art events.
I'm really curious with this, if how much they show how the selection of art or the presentation of art is affected by other factors, if they have discussions, how detailed or explicit they get.
Yeah, no, there's many scenes of them discussing why things should be chosen, representation issues, certain nationalities or subcultures or things represented. But the actual invitation process is kind of interesting. A lot of the beginning of the film is them going to different countries and watching. For example, they go to Africa and they watch a guy, he's a kind of a street type performer, and he does performance art.
Mm-hmm.
And they watch his performance and then go and introduce themselves and say who they are, and they invite him to the thing. And I don't know how
oh, wow.
yeah, it's just insane. They're just like, yeah, we run Documenta, and like we'd like to keep in contact with you. And so they literally, they go and invite people in person.
Cool.
But there are actually scenes with, like I was saying, with the filmmakers. So you do see some of those filmmakers in the film, like talking to them as they prepare. And it is told like achronologically. So it kind of jumps. It kind of starts with some dramatic elements. So you see them, the guy, the main curator, like freaking out. You know, he's under so much stress and he's like wants to essentially quit. And he's so angry about everything that's going on and the bad press. And then it jumps back and shows the beginning and how it gets organized, and it kind of jumps back and forth throughout. But there are all these like stylized moments where, unlike a Wiseman film, which is, you know, very kind of stately and observational, but there's, in this film, there's like montage sequences with music and club type scenes, and the curator's kind of like going out afterward and partying. And so there's a little more like rhythm to the film in the just kind of the traditional sense, rather than just like straight watching people discuss like internal bureaucratic matters for 14 hours.
Yeah. Wiseman is the poet laureate of the meeting.
Yes, so exactly.
Not everyone has the stamina for that. Well, that's pretty fascinating. I'm pretty curious where that will show next and how it will be received.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to show properly, or how they want it shown. Again, I don't know how that's going to work. Like here it was shown 14 chapters over 2 days, 7 each day. So about 7 hours per day with a break, I think, at one point. So... We got a LaFleur problem on our hands again, where we got a...
LaFleur problem, yeah. They should also just get that writer from LaFleur to talk about this as well. He became like part of the show, basically.
Exactly.
The Q&As. So, yeah, that's definitely like very special event here, kind of unique. Is that in a section or is it...
Yeah, Berlinale Special.
Special. It is special.
It is special, yeah.
Although it's different probably than most of the other things that are in the special, or a lot of them.
Yeah, special is kind of I don't know how they decide what goes in there. It's sort of like a catch-all. Like there's some bigger name... There's some name filmmakers in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, you could totally see this being like in Encounters, like The Works and Days was. But I don't know why they would have kept it out exactly. I'm sure there's reasons, but...
Yeah.
It could be just the sheer fact that I think when they program things in Encounters, like it has to show in a certain theater, which is quite large, and they might not... Yeah, there's reasons. I think there's like logistical reasons why you might put it in another section to play it in a smaller theater since it's a 14-hour movie. But
yeah, hopefully I will see it at some point. It just did not work out for me here. But another film that I also did not see but want to hear about, I guess, sounds like more of like an essay film than a documentary per se. Henry Fonda for President, directed by Alexander Horwath.
Yes. He ran the Biennale for a while in the 90s and then was the director of the Austrian Film Museum for many years until just like 5 years ago or something. So he's a renowned cinephile and like a scholar. So this is his first film, though.
Yeah, but not his first film appearance.
No.
I believe he appears in Mutzenbacher.
Oh, you're right. He does. I forgot about that. That's funny.
Which is weird.
Oh, that's weird, yeah. If you know the subject of that film.
Anyway.
No, so this is an essay film about cinema, about Henry Fonda. So it's like right up his alley. I think you were mentioning to me that he's written about Fonda at length, probably.
I want to say, yeah.
He must have. He's like a...
He's really, really interesting.
Is essentially telling Henry Fonda's entire life story. But in an interesting way, when he was young, Alexander Horwath discovered Henry Fonda like early 80s as like an adolescent, I guess. And... became one of his favorite actors, but he's using Fonda in this film as like a representation or reflection on like the American dream, I guess, or the American male, and also like maybe like leftist politics and how that evolved over the 20th century and even longer, because the film is interesting in the sense that it doesn't follow Henry Fonda's life story chronologically. It follows it chronologically through his films in the dates that they were set in. Uh-huh. So it starts in like the 1600s, like with some of the westerns he made. In the order it goes, there's a lot of John Ford and like John Wayne type overlap in the beginning. And then as he makes more modern set films, it moves in that direction. So it's not like it didn't start with his childhood.
Having not seen it, I mean, obviously you'll have Young Mr. Lincoln in there.
A lot of the Young Mr. Lincoln in there. Fort Apache.
Does it go up to Failsafe?
There is Failsafe. Uh-huh. It's super exhaustive. I mean, it goes up, obviously, until On Golden Pond. It is his last film. Yes, I have Failsafe written here in my notes. But yes, so it goes through everything, like the McCarthy era, which he was opposed to and lost friendships over, including to John Wayne.
Yeah, that's part of what I'm intrigued that obviously that's the kind of counterforce to it.
Is
John Wayne is the stereotype of the macho American.
Yeah.
But also, completely destructive.
And I should say, I guess, it is the narrative is based on the last recorded interview that Henry Fonda did in 1981 or so, or maybe it's like 82. I think with a German journalist or something. So it's audio tape, audio recording of him speaking.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so there's voiceover by Fonda answering questions from this guy. And then Alexander Horvath provides additional, like, you know, philosophical banter about the films and his personal connection with the films. So it's very interesting in that way. And he's not very nostalgic for, like, the movies. He's very, like, cut and dry about, like, what they mean, not really saying, like, because a lot of people would ask him, like, oh, you identify with these characters, like, is the Grapes of Wrath, like, your most personal film? And he's, like, doesn't really identify with the character, even though you would think, because it's, like, you know, a political film in a way, and people identify him and his politics with, like, that, those ideas in Grapes of Wrath, for example.
Yeah,
But it does touch on a lot of the political issues, and then also dives into, you know, Peter Fonda and Jane Fonda in the 60s and his relationship with them a little bit. Yeah, and there's just interesting footage and things. Some things I didn't even realize, just, like, basic things that might be common knowledge, but, like, he never went to the Oscars except when he accepted his Lifetime Achievement Award, and then he won an Oscar the following year for his last film and didn't go to get it, and he was never interested in the Oscars, and he's, like, talks about just going the one time because he's, like, my peers wanted to honor me, so I went, but otherwise he never appeared at any of these award shows, and yeah, so it's a fascinating film, and, like, it's probably one that Alexander Horvath was, like, born to make in some sense. But yes, oh, like, 3 hours long, very exhaustive as well.
Wow. And is it entirely footage from the films, or is it also, like, interview footage of him?
Yeah, there is interview footage of him. There are sequences where he goes to the locations now from the films and shoots. So there are, like, the Western things from, like, My Darling Clementine. He goes to, like, where that was shot, like, OK Corral area, I guess. So, yeah, he does do that a lot, too. So it does juxtapose locations and the settings.
Yeah.
There's a sort of a Los Angeles Plays Itself type feel to the film, which, I mean, it's one of the great films. But it's in that essay cinema mode, which I quite enjoy. And it's much more, like, thorough and theoretical. Yeah, like a very, very long, good video essay.
And I really like the concept of the project, too, somehow tracing a chronology through the clips of the movies. And
oh yeah, I guess the title too is, I had never heard of this show actually, I can't remember the name of it now, but there is a show that uses the phrase Henry Fonda for president, where Henry Fonda appeared in the show as this, like, a woman wanted him to run for president in like the 70s because his political beliefs and whatnot, so they use that as like a jumping off point. I think the show is called Maude. Do you know this show? I think it was from, it's from,
oh sure, yeah, that was a big sitcom.
Yeah, what's her name from the Golden Girls was in it.
Not B. Arthur, no.
But anyway, her character in that film has a idea to have Henry Fonda run for president. So they use clips from that show in it, which he appeared in.
That's
so
funny.
Yeah.
Sometimes reading him or reading about him, he comes off a bit cold.
Yeah, I think that might be part of the reason he made it, too. It does, humanize the work, but it does give you just more insight into, like, him as a person.
Yeah.
Like, his life wasn't cinema, necessarily.
Yeah.
You know? He acted because he was good at it, it seemed like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't romanticize it at all. He's not...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, seems like... Yeah, just sort of...
He's like, that's just something I made, you know, at the time.
I guess stoic, but not making a big thing about being stoic as well, in a way. All right, we can finish up with that one, although I do want to hear about one other film, which I think was a big highlight for you, which is Republic.
Oh, Republic, yes. Yeah, I'll talk briefly about it. I haven't really formulated a ton of thoughts on it. I saw it yesterday. It's a Chinese documentary. It's about I don't even know how to describe them, like a hippie commune, like a modern-day hippie commune, I guess. Young Chinese kids who, they are not homeless because they all live in a room that's like tucked off, I guess it's in Beijing, tucked off in the lower part of a building, and it's a very small space, and they're like 10 of them live in this little room, and they're all obsessed with late 60s psychedelic rock, so basically like, you know, Beatles and Pink Floyd, and so all they do is, not all, but they do a lot of drugs, and they play music together, so they're all musicians, and they have like computers and things like this, and they get into, you know, as you do when you're doing drugs and making music, like quasi-philosophical conversations about things, about life. They make money, I guess, by going out and playing, like, they don't have any footage of this, it's all shot in this room, so it's a little claustrophobic, and it's all neon, like it's like looks like a late 60s flower power type look to the room, so everything's like neon flashing lights, and so it's got interesting, like, I don't know, natural production design to it. So like aesthetically it's very beautiful to look at, but they seem to go out and perform for like money on the streets, and they eat and live that way, But they're very, the Republic is the name, they've given the name to this space that they've created. It's like a self-sustaining autonomous artist commune, I guess you could call it, even like romantically. Yeah, so they all live there and just they have their little dramas and things like that, but it's very, yeah, just a strange community that I don't know how this filmmaker found this out about them or what, but it's interesting. And it's also hilarious to just watch them play music, and they're just obsessed. I don't know, it's like when I was 20 and I like loved you know, Revolution Number 9 was like the craziest thing you've ever heard in your life. You know, that's all they do, is like their minds are blown by Pink Floyd and by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Velvet Underground. But
wow,
yeah.
Is there like a self-consciousness about how that is apart from a lot of what's going on in the world? Like, is there a sense of it as like a refuge or as...
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a conscious choice because they talk about modern, they talk about Trump, they talk about modern things. So they're plugged in, like literally they have like phones and they're... Yeah, it's just like a decision. They've decided to live off the grid, but like in like literally, I don't know how big the place is. It's like a one-bedroom apartment, essentially.
Wow.
It has like two decks. It's like a kind of a bunk bed type, but built into the wall. So like some of them are kind of like hang out on the big bed up on top, and then other ones are just strewn about downstairs. And
But not a cult.
But not a cult, no. And they, yeah, they make food together, and yeah. But it's very... Yeah, it's a fascinating movie. I don't really know. I was not expecting what it was when I saw it.
I'm going to have to track this one down.
I guess imagine like a Wong Bing making a film about a community like this, sort of like in that style. Like it's an observational type thing, but it's like embedded in there. So it's not like the camera's moving and it, you know, it is a little more like involving formally than like a standard just like removed look. It's like, because it has to be like right in with them because it's such a small space. But it has that feeling of being just like immersed in their community for a couple hours.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Republic. All right. Well, we'll end there. I think we talked about like such like different and absolutely distinctive movies.
It's true, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the slate this year, I think it's shaping up to be pretty good. We're only like halfway done. Maybe not even that.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's been like a real diverse, I'm just talking like stylistically and like just what the movies are about. It's just very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah. And that's, you know, part of why we've been coming here is for that. Well, we'll go off now and see more movies to talk about.
Anything you're looking forward to, Nick? Or I'll turn the question around on you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the easy answer is there's another Hong Sang-soo movie. There's always another Hong Sang-soo movie.
Even if you've seen this one, there's another new one coming soon, I'm sure.
Just like, wait for the next train. Oh, as I have put on the record publicly, I'm looking forward to Pepe.
Oh, yeah. I won't spoil it, but I think you'll like it.
Which is the next film from...
Nelson Carlos de los Santos Arias.
Who made Cocote.
Don't ask me how I know that.
Yeah. Made Cocote. He's Dominican.
Dominican, yeah.
One of like a small handful of Dominican filmmakers.
Yeah, this is like many years in the making of film. Cocote was like 2017, the year of those films we were talking about from Documenta. I think that was that same year.
And I've been actually waiting for it since then because I interviewed him about Cocote when it premiered at Locarno and asked him, what are you doing next?
Oh, so he already had the idea then. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, he said that, I don't know if he had just been in Colombia, but he had said like, I was in Colombia and I have this story now about this hippo. Maybe it was like one of the like drug lords got a bunch of hippos for his zoo. Maybe it was Escobar.
Yeah, it was Escobar. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, he says in the interview that I would like to make a movie from the perspective of a hippo. That's what he said. And he says, I don't know if I can, but I want to do it. And I said, I'd watch that.
Yeah.
and now
you are.
And now I will.
He took you up on that.
Yeah. He took me up on it. All right. Thank you, Jordan.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapolt. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.